Good morning, everyone. Before we start today's shir, I just want to say we're dedicating today's shir to Shmuel Tzvi ben Rav Yosef. That's Rona's husband, whose yahrzeit is in a few days, on the 21st of Iyar. So we dedicate in his name. I wish that the neshama should have an aliyah, and we bench the whole family with only good things and simchas and gute zachen.
Thank you.
So it's Parshas Behar, page 696. A couple of introductions. First of all, it's a special week this week. We just had Pesach Sheni on Sunday, the second chance. We have Lag BaOmer coming up this Thursday, so it's a good week. Morning. What I want to do is just run through an overview of the parasha. And then I'm going to go into something at the beginning of the parasha, which we've touched upon before, but we'll do it from a different angle, and then go into something which we haven't done before at the end of the parasha. So the overview of the parasha is the parasha starts off with the laws of Shemitah. Every 7 years, the land in Israel has to lie fallow. No work can be done, and so on and so forth, which then runs into the mitzvah of Yovel. Yovel is every 50 years, the Jubilee year. After seven Shemitahs, there's a special Yovel year, which all mitzvahs supply. Then we have a whole section to do with redeeming real estate. You know, in Israel in times of old, part of the Yovel system was that you couldn't actually sell a field forever because the fields remained within their tribes, so therefore they were more leased than sold. And therefore there's all kinds of different laws and mitzvahs of which real estate you could redeem, which you can't redeem, buy it early, give back the money, and so on and so forth. We also read in this parasha, it's not the only parasha we read, but we read in this parasha about the prohibition, the Issur of Ribis, which is lending money on interest, which you're not allowed to do. Treatment of slaves comes into the parasha, how we treat slaves, even though we call them slaves, but actually they need to be treated very well. We have a concept of Jewish slaves. If a slave is sold either to a Jew or to a non-Jew, we have a whole section of how to redeem a slave, to get him back out of slavery as soon as possible. And at the end of the parasha talks again about the prohibition of avodah zarah, idol worship. The mitzvah of Shabbos is mentioned again. And that's it. The number 9 is a typo from last week. That's stayed in there from last week for some reason. Okay. Let's have a look. As I said, we'll do something in the beginning of the parasha, at the end of the parasha. Let's have a look at the beginning of the parasha, page 696, Parshas Behar. So we start off with the laws of Shemitah, the famous pasuk. The pasuk says, "Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe," and Hashem spoke to Moshe, "Bahar Sinai Lemar," on Har Sinai, saying. So he spoke to him at Har Sinai. This is, of course, this parasha is way after the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai, but this is what the pasuk says: "Daber al Bnei Yisrael, speak to the Bnei Yisrael, ve'amarto aleim, and say to them, ki suvoyu el oretz, when you come to the land." Asher ani noisein lochem, which I will give you, v'shof soha oretz Shabbos laHashem, and the land will rest a Shabbos for God. It's called a Shabbos for God. Every 7 years, like Shabbos, we keep once a week, once every 7 days. This is once every 7 years. What is the Shemitah? Shei shonim tizra sadecha, for 6 years you shall sow your field. Shei shonim tizmer kamecha, for 6 years you should prune your vineyards. V'safta es tfuoso, you should gather in the produce. Ubashona Hashvis, in the 7th year, Shabbos Shabbosa and Yil Oretz, it should be a complete Shabbos for the land, Shabbos LaHashem, Sotcha Loisizra, you should not sow your fields, Harmacha Loisizra, you should not prune your vineyards, and so on and so forth. And it goes on to tell all the different details of the laws of Shemitah. Okay. So there's a very famous Rashi at the beginning of the parasha. Just to make it easier, I printed it in print font on your handout. Let's read it together. So the Rashi really is in two parts. The first part of Rashi quotes a brisa, which means quotes something from the Gemara, or from the time of the Gemara at least. And then Rashi gives his interpretation. So Rashi says the following. Famous question. Ma inyan Shemitah etzel Har Sinai? What does Shemitah got to do with Har Sinai? Why all of a sudden did the Torah emphasize that Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai? Right? This is such a famous question, by the way. I'm sure I mentioned this before, but it's such a famous question that in yeshivas, when when we used to talk to like people who have learned in Yeshiva, put it this way, when they talk to each other, and often during the English language, a lot of other stuff is mixed in, so it's a bit of like Yeshiva English, not regular English. It's like when we speak, especially as Bachrim, you know, a bit of Yiddish, a bit of quotes from Gemara, things like that. So if someone said something that had no connection to the discussion, the normal response would be, excuse me, Ma inyan shmita etz l'har Sinai. What has shmita got to do with Har Sinai? Because it's a phrase which is taken from here. In fact, it's a used phrase. Even in Svarim, you find this phrase sometimes, not with regard to shmita, but with regard to if someone quotes literature that brings in something that seems not to be connected, they'll use the phrase Ma inyan shmita etz l'har Sinai. Right? Because the Torah never does this. The Torah never mentions Har Sinai when it comes to a mitzvah. We've had many mitzvahs. We just had Parshas Kedoshim, which was full of mitzvahs. It doesn't say that it was done at Har Sinai. Right? So Rashi continues. Ma inyan shmita etzla Har Sinai. V'haloi kol ha-mitzvahs nemru mi-Sinai. All the mitzvahs were given at Sinai. Ela, but the answer is, and again, this is Rashi, not Rashi himself, this is Rashi quoting from an earlier source in the Talmud. Ela ma shmita nemru kloloiseho uproteiseho v'digdukeho mi-Sinai. What the Torah is telling us is that just as the Torah gives all the details here at Shmita to tell us, that just as Shmita was given all of its details, all of its nuances, all the specifics were all given at Har Sinai, af kulan, all of them, nemru kloloisehen v'digdukehen mi-Sinai. All of the mitzvahs, not just the general principles, but even the details and the specifics were given at Har Sinai. That's why the Torah says it. Kach shenuya b'Torahs Kohanim. This is what's Rashi quoting from something called Torahs Kohanim, which is from the Tanaic literature, similar to the time of the Mishnah. So Rashi explains, what does he mean? V'nirali. Shekach pirusha. This is the explanation. Lefi, because we find an interesting thing. You know, we have where Rashi is really going with this is as follows. Often we have mitzvahs in the Torah which are only written early on in the Torah very briefly. And then the details we are given in Sefer Dvarim, in Deuteronomy, at the end, where Moshe Rabbeinu repeats the whole Torah. And over there we seem to see that it gives a lot of details, which could lead you to the conclusion that that's the way the mitzvahs were given. Actually weren't given specifically at Har Sinai. Only the principles were given at Har Sinai. Right? By the way, when I talk about Har Sinai, I don't mean the day of Har Sinai, because in that day only 10 commandments were given. I mean, in the 120 days that followed, that Moshe Rabbeinu spent on the mountain learning all the specifics of Torah and so on. Right?
Given to Moshe.
Given to Moshe, and then given to the Bnei, Moshe would then come and communicate it to the Bnei Yisrael. But we could be led to a conclusion that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't give everything at the beginning. That he waited 40 years, and it's only in Sefer Dvarim, at the last couple of weeks of his life, that's when he explored the specifics of some of the mitzvahs. So the Torah here is teaching us not to think that way. Why? Says Rashi, because lefi shelo matzinu shmitas karkois, we actually don't find the laws of shmita shenishnis ba'arvas moya b'mishnah Torah. We don't find that the shmita was repeated in Dvarim, as other mitzvahs are repeated. Although it's called Mishnah Torah, which presumably all the mitzvahs are repeated there, right? Shekol luseinu partasein kul nemru mi-Sinai. We see here clearly that obviously they didn't need to be repeated in Dvarim because all the specifics were already given Har Sinai, right? That's why the pasuk here comes and emphasizes the word Har Sinai when it comes to Shemitah. The limit kan al kol dibur. Actually, that's an extrapolation to all mitzvahs. Shenadaber leMoshe that were given to Moshe. Shemi Sinai hayukulam klalusem v'digdukayin. That already at Sinai all the specifics and all the details were given. The chazru v'nishnu be'arvas moev, and they're all just repeated in Arvas Moev, which is the book of Devarim. Okay. The Ramban has a little bit of a different take on this, because the Ramban says he doesn't like Rashi's interpretation on the Braisa, because you could actually say it's the other way around. If Shmita was not repeated later and it was given here in the specifics, maybe there's an exception. Maybe only Shmita was given the specifics. Anyway, he gives it a bit different. He says, you see that, if you look, this is already the second time the Torah talks about Shmita, because the truth is the first time, in other words, this is already a repetition. The first time Torah talks about Shmita is in Parshas Mishpatim. Just after Matan Torah, we find very briefly Shmita is given. And now it's repeated again, right? And the Torah says Har Sinai. So that's more of a proof, in other words, that the general principle which was given at Har Sinai and the specifics are all at Har Sinai. So from there we extrapolate to all mitzvahs that were given, the specifics and the details were all given at Har Sinai. Okay. But the obvious question is, whatever the Torah is trying to teach us with this Shmita, bottom line is, how you interpret it, how you understand the Braisa, the message is clear. that the Torah is teaching us that all the principles of the mitzvahs and the specifics were all given at Har Sinai, and the Torah chose Shemitah to teach us that. And the obvious question is, why did the Torah pick Shemitah to teach us that principle? The Torah could have done the same thing with any mitzvah. If we need one mitzvah to be the guiding mitzvah to teach us how all mitzvahs were taught, the Torah could have chosen any mitzvah. Why Har Sinai? Why Shemitah? Right? Why is the Shemitah mitzvah specifically connected with emphasis to Har Sinai? That's what the Mefarshim asks. So the Kiyakar says a beautiful pshat. He says the following. He says like this. He says Har Sinai the mitzvah of Shemitah is linked to Har Sinai, and so is the mitzvah of Yovel, the Jubilee year, in ways that other mitzvahs aren't. Why? So he says what happens as follows. First of all, let's just understand the mitzvah of Yovel. What happens is like this. We have the mitzvah of Shemitah, right? Where you have 6 years you work the land, and then 7 years, in the seventh year, you're not allowed to work the land. You can't sow, you can't plow. Then comes the 50th year. The 50th year, also you can't work and you can't plow the land. And there's some additional stuff that happens in the 50th year. What happens in the 50th year? The slaves go free. Jewish slaves cannot work past the 50th year. We know that we learned in Parashat Mishpatim that if a Jewish slave is sold, he works for 6 years, he goes free in the seventh, but if he wants to stay on, he can. But by the time the Yovel comes, by the Jubilee year, the slaves have to go free. That was one of the hallmarks of Yovel. What used to happen in Yovel, nowadays we don't have Yovel, but what used to happen in Yovel was it was after seven Shemitahs, and then what happened was they would blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah of Yovel, but in the Yovel year, they would also blow shofar on Yom Kippur. And then when they blew shofar on Yom Kippur, that was a sign for all the slaves to go free, and everyone would go free. Land would then return to its original owner. That was the process of the Yovel. Says the Kli Yakar, what happened when the Yidden came out of Mitzrayim? They had 7 weeks. 7 weeks they came working towards Har Sinai, right? In the seventh week, when they came close to Har Sinai, they actually camped at Har Sinai on Rosh Chodesh Sivan, 6 days before the Torah was given. And Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, tell everyone to stay away from the mountain. Up until then, it was a regular mountain. You could do stuff on it, you can work on it, you can walk on it, whatever. Suddenly, in the seventh week, the mountain became holy. They had to stay away from the mountain. Even today, we have something called that we call 3 days before Shavuos. We call it Shloshis Yemei Hagbola, the 3 days of preparation, but it's called Yemei Hagbola. The Hagbola means to stay away. They had to put a fence around the mountain. No one should go there. Only Moshe Rabbeinu was allowed to go on the mountain. And then came the 50th. So that was in the seventh week, just like Shemitah. It was a regular mountain for 6 weeks. Suddenly, the seventh week, you can't touch the mountain. You can't plant anything there. You can't go there. It's a holy mountain. Then comes the 50th day, similar to the Yovel, the 50th year. What happens the 50th day? There's a big shofar. When Hashem gave the Torah, the shofar blew. And we got the Torah. And the Torah are called Luchos HaBris. They're called the Tablets of Covenant. And in Parshas Kisiso, he quotes a famous idea where the Torah says that the Ten Commandments were given on the tablets of stone, and the expression is used, Chorus al haluchos. Chorus means they were engraved on the luchos. So the Chazal tell us that you need to take the word chorus and read a different word similar to the word chorus, which is chairus, freedom. That when the Torah was given, freedom was given. That the true freedom of a human being only comes through the Torah. By being connected to the Torah and not being slaves to our own temptations and our own dispositions and our own personality, but by following a moral code which is outside of us, which is absolute, which transports us to a whole new level, which connects us to Hashem, we experience freedom through the Torah. So freedom was given just like in the Yovel when the slaves go free. So he says that's one of the hints that when Hashem gave the Torah in Har Sinai, he said he's going to give a mitzvah similar to Shemitah, similar to Matan Torah, in the land of Eretz Yisrael. And he gave us specifically coming out of Har Sinai, to remember the event of Har Sinai, says the Kli Yakar, he gave us the law of Shemitah and Yovel, because it resembles the whole process of Har Sinai. 7 weeks there was a regular mountain, 6 weeks was a regular mountain, the seventh week it was holy, the 50th day was like Yovel, shofar, we became free, just like Yovel is a shofar, extra shofar, and the slaves go free. And that's why, if there's one mitzvah that the Torah has to emphasize Har Sinai, it specifically takes Shemitah and Yovel because of the link, the direct link between Shemitah and Yovel and Har Sinai. Yeah, sure, please.
Why is it so important to tell if it was given brought up front or 40 years later.
No, I hear that. Because one of the fundamentals of Yiddishkeit is that every part of who we are comes from Har Sinai. That's our identity comes from Har Sinai, right? And therefore, we learn that even, like, there's an expression in the Gemara that even if a Talmud Vosik, which means a Torah Talmudic scholar, nowadays will come up with an innovative idea, which we're supposed to do, by the way, we're supposed to, within certain rules and so on, it was all given Har Sinai. What does it mean, all given Har Sinai? It doesn't mean all necessarily was explicitly given Har Sinai, but it was all potentially given Har Sinai. Everything that is true in Torah is because it's rooted in Har Sinai. And therefore, the point here is, by the way, it's not everyone agrees with this. Because we're taking one approach here. Rashi take one approach. I think, from memory, it's a dispute between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel. But the approach is that the importance of Har Sinai was so great that the mitzvahs that we have, for example, we have the mitzvah of Bris Milah, which was given before Har Sinai. It was given to Avraham Avinu, right? The mitzvah of circumcision. So the Rambam points out very, very clearly that we need to understand that although we call it the Bris of Avraham Avinu, we don't keep it because it was given to Avraham Avinu. We only keep it because it was given to Har Sinai. So according to this view, the emphasis of that is so great to teach us that not only the general principles were given to Har Sinai, but even the specifics were given to Har Sinai. Just to teach us how rooted we are in the event of Har Sinai. Others say, no, the seeds were planted at Har Sinai, but some of it was revealed later. In other words, the point of saying everything was given to Har Sinai is that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he came in the 40th year, he didn't give us any new mitzvahs. It wasn't like there was new mitzvahs. Just like today, we don't have any new mitzvahs. Even the new mitzvahs we do have, which are rabbinic mitzvahs, also have to be within a certain context that they rooted in Har Sinai somehow. Like they were given a mandate to be able to do that, and so on. But anyways, but that's the concept we learn from Shmita. But why Shmita is because of this word, because of the link to Har Sinai, which is a very interesting take on Shmita. Our altar, yeah. So, I mean, so that's a famous question, just to put in a plug. I'm actually giving a two-part series starting this coming Monday called, it's coming Monday night. Two Monday nights, I'm giving a series called From Sinai to You, to actually explain how the whole chain of the oral Torah actually works and how Lachas, we've done it many years ago. But it's a very, very important topic because we need to understand what that means that Moshe Rabbeinu was taught the whole oral Torah. For example, there's a famous medrash where there's a vision that Moshe Rabbeinu showed a vision of Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva is teaching things he doesn't understand, and he never heard of, and he got weak. And then all of a sudden, and he doesn't understand, how could it be? He got the whole Torah, and Rabbi Akiva is teaching things he didn't know. Suddenly he hears the Talmidim, in his vision, he hears the students of Rabbi Akiva asking Rabbi Akiva, where do you know this from? And Rabbi Akiva says, Halach la Moshe Misinai. So we need to understand what that means. Not obviously... Moshe Rabbeinu didn't sit down in the 120 days and learn the Mishnah Berurah, learn the Shulchan Aruch Harav, or whatever. He didn't learn all the Sfarim that are, but everything he learned all the principles, and everything that we come up with today, any halacha that's developed, any response to a new question, has to go back to principles and teachings that were given at Har Sinai, and therefore were potentially. It's like a seed of a tree. Nothing can grow in the tree if it's not potentially in the seed already, right? If it's not. What do you mean?
What's the kind of fact that everything in the beginning? Because the seed is not everything.
No, so this is not talking about Torah learning. This is talking about the specifics of the mitzvahs as they applied then. In other words, the Torah gave mitzvah Shmita, so the Torah doesn't say keep Shmita and later on I'll tell you what it is. It gave us the specifics. It gave us the specifics of Shabbos. Now, that doesn't mean that he told us if we can use a kosher switch or not. But we use those specifics and we try to apply it. Right? So it needs to develop exactly what all this means. But this is what Rashi brings. Okay, just to stay on Shmita for a few moments. So again, we've done this before, but I'll just share with you a bit of a different angle. Just to again something that the Kli Yakar says on Shmita. What is the purpose? What is the mitzvah of Shmita? So the Rambam in the Guide to Perplex and Moreh Nevuchim says, as the Rambam does in the Guide to Perplex, always using a rational approach. Rambam says that the reason for Shmita is the Torah says that it's natural, that if you want the nutrients in the land to work properly, you need to give the land a break once in a while. Right? That's what the Rambam explains. And therefore the Torah obligated, because it was important to work the land and to make sure that the land of Eretz Yisrael reaches its fullest potential. Therefore the Rambam says that in order for the land not to become weak, therefore there's a mitzvah of Shmita every 7 years. So the Mefarshim, including the Kli Yakar, asks on this, it's a very, very strange pshat, because two things. First of all, why then does the Pasuk call it Shabbos LaHashem? Calls it a Shabbos, like there's a holiness to the Shemitah. If the Rambam's reason is the only reason, I mean, it might be a side benefit, but if it's the only reason, then it's not actually a Shabbos LaHashem, it's just an agricultural strategy. He says it's a Shabbos LaAdama, it's a Shabbos for the land, not a Shabbos for Hashem, right? This is the phrase he uses. So he quotes others that say, and this is, he quotes the Akedah, but other Rishonim say this as well, that the mitzvah of Shemitah is similar to Shabbos, in that it's there to remind ourselves of the Sheishes and Meberesha, the 6 days of creation. Just like Hashem created the world in 6 days, rest on the seventh, when we keep Shemitah, it is the way of the land, through the land, acknowledging that Hashem created the world, and that 6 days He created the world, and the seventh day He rested. The problem with that is, as the Kli Yakar points out, why do we need two mitzvahs to accomplish the same thing? That's what Shabbos does. Every Shabbos we keep because we acknowledge Hashem's creation. So why is it necessary then to have another Shabbos, another sort of different kind of Shabbos, to reach the same conclusion? So he says the following, as some of the other Mefarshim point out as well. He says Shemitah is a bit different. Shemitah actually takes Shabbos to a whole new level, right? Shabbos, he doesn't say these words, but I'm going to just paraphrase it, but I think that's what he's trying to say. Shabbos is about Emunah, Shemitah is about Bitochem. What do I mean? Shabbos, you keep Shabbos, so you acknowledge that everything comes from Hashem, and that Hashem created the world, and that, right? And everything He gives us is from Him, and so on and so forth. Shemitah takes the whole new level. Shemitah forces the person to have amazing bitachon. Why? There is no mitzvah like Shemitah that actually, in a very natural way, puts people at risk. There's no mitzvah like that. Even Shabbos. Okay, there were circumstances where a person thinks that on Shabbos, if he doesn't work, he'll lose that profit, and so on and so forth, right? There were times in America when the Yidden came where they were tested, and we shouldn't judge. They were tested amazingly. People used to lose their jobs if they didn't work on Shabbos, and so on and so forth. But generally speaking, when a person does and accomplishes and produces, one day a week is not going to make a big difference. It could affect it, but it won't lose his livelihood. Not to work the entire year in a field when you live in an agricultural society is incredible. And therefore, it's the only mitzvah that does this, actually. It's the only mitzvah that the normal observance of the mitzvah forces people to go into natural risk. For which purpose? The purpose of absolute bitachon, to actually surrender and just for 1 year force yourself to say, I'm in God's hands. And God says later that the reward for that mitzvah, the reward of bitachon, when we give ourselves over to Hashem, which means when we give ourselves up and we put ourselves in the hands of God, which is a lesson always in bitachon. Bitachon is a very hard thing. We've talked a lot about bitachon. But when a person has true bitachon, the response from Hashem is infinite. Why? Because when you take yourself out of your limited context, if you hang on to yourself, this is our problem always as human beings. When we hang on to ourselves, we're finite human beings, so then the results are finite. When we give ourselves over completely, we do what Hashem wants us to do responsibly, but the truth is that we surrender to God, then we let God do the job, then He's infinite. So He says an amazing thing. The Pasuk later on tells us, what's the reward for Shemitah? He says, if you're going to say, what are we going to eat during Shemitah? Hashem will cause the land extra bracha, abundant bracha, and you'll have what to eat for the sixth year, for the seventh year, and of course the eighth year, because at the beginning of the eighth year, you haven't planted yet, so you still need time, right? So he says, actually, this bracha that Hashem gives, that in the sixth year, the field, if you commit it to Shemitah, the field will produce almost enough for 3 years, is what he calls a nes besoich nes. It's a miracle, it's an amazing miracle. Why? First of all, the fact that the field should all of a sudden give more than normal. That's one miracle. The second miracle is that it's the sixth year. Because we mentioned before what the Rambam says, which is true, but just that's not the whole reason of Shemitah. The truth is that the more you use the field, the weaker it is. So which is the year that the Torah says the field will give more? The weakest year. The one before you give it a break. Right? And that's the reward for Shemitah. She says that also explains why the Torah says later on in next week's parasha that if we don't keep Shemitah, and in fact the Chazal tell us this is what happened in the first Beis HaMikdash, they were not careful with Shemitah, and therefore the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and they went into the 70 years of Bavel, mainly because they didn't keep Shemitah. That was one of the, why? Why? Because you don't give Shemitah, what's the punishment? He says, what's the connection? So, the connection is because if you don't keep Shemitah, that means you're not surrendering to Hashem, and therefore you're not giving yourself over to the protection of Hashem. If you don't give yourself over to the protection of Hashem, you leave yourself vulnerable to the invasion of other nations. Because it's all about Bitochen. Shemitah is all about giving ourselves over in the hands of Hashem. And that's why the Golus comes, because of the lack of Shemitah.
So could you say that action in this case is inaction?
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like, well, that's how you do the mitzvah. By, correct. Okay. I had 4 years. Yeah, it was a double. It was a double Shemitah. It was unbelievable. Yeah. Okay. Now I want to go through something which I don't know if we've done before, but towards the end of the parasha, a very interesting idea, which I'm going to share with you. It's actually to do with Shabbos. It's a general Shabbos concept, but it comes into this parasha. At the end of the parasha, if you go to if you go to page 706. It's got nothing to do with what we just did. It's a new thing. Okay, so it's talking about a Jewish slave, that if someone is desperate or destitute and he gets sold as a slave, and sometimes what happens is that a Jewish person can get sold into slavery with a non-Jewish owner because they just need the money. So there's a mitzvah to try and get that person freed and redeem the person and so on and so forth. And the Torah tells how to treat slavery and all that. Then the Torah says, because you need to know that ultimately a person slavery is not a good situation, because as the Pasuk says in Nun 55, Ki li b'nei Yisrael avodim, because the Jewish people are my slaves, avodahem asher atzoisi esim es Mitzrayim, ani Hashem alakechem. Which is why, you know, we have the thing in Mishpatim that if a Jewish slave wants to stay on beyond the 6 years, he's punished with his ear being pierced, because really a person shouldn't be a slave to other people. We need to be a slave only to God. Then the parasha ends with the following. First of all, the parasha ends with a warning not to serve idol worship. You shouldn't make idols. You shouldn't erect monuments for maskis or stones to bow down. And then at the end, all of a sudden, the pasuk says, you should keep my Shabbos, migdoshi tiro'u, and fear my Beis HaMikdosh, ani Hashem, I am God. So just a couple of general things about this thing. First of all, Rashi says that actually this whole parasha is all connected. Rashi says what happens is, first of all, why does the Torah suddenly tell us don't serve idols? Because the Torah is coming just off the back of a situation where a person is sold into slavery, sometimes to a non-Jewish master. So therefore Rashi says Hashem is telling us that a person shouldn't say, look, I'm a slave to my master now, so I'll behave the way my master behaves. This was talking about in a time of tremendous pagan worship, a pagan worship culture. So therefore, just like my master serves idols, I'll serve idols. Just like my master doesn't keep Shabbos, I won't keep Shabbos. That's why all of a sudden, at the end of the parasha, there's this warning, don't serve idols, keep Shabbos, and so on, which are all very, very fundamental mitzvahs. In general, the Rashi says that it's all connected. In fact, the whole parasha is a warning. The parasha is saying, look, I'll give you the mitzvah of Shemitah. If you don't keep Shemitah, you're not going to gain. You're going to have to sell your fields. In other words, it won't bring blessing to your resources at all. And therefore, we have the laws of selling fields and giving back fields. At the end, people have to sell their houses, as the Torah talks about. At the end, if you don't listen, you'll have to sell yourself. And that's all, therefore, it's all connected to these different events. The Baal HaTurim says an interesting thing about Shabbos here. He says, if you look at the end of the last pasuk, it says, Es shabsoisai tishmoiru. My Shabbos you shall guard. In the Aseres Hadibros, in the Ten Commandments, the second one in Dvarim, we also have the term of Shmirah, to keep Shabbos. It says Shomer es Yom HaShabbos, guard the Shabbos. Same, but there it says to guard before the word Shabbos. Here it says Shabbos before the word to God, and there it says guard before the word of Shabbos. The Baal Turim says, and this is a hint to a very, very famous halacha. We have this halacha, that every Shabbos, besides keeping Shabbos, we're supposed to add on a little bit before Shabbos and after Shabbos. That's why we light candles a little bit before. And even Shabbos times, if you look at the calendar and it tells you when Shabbos goes out, it's actually a little bit after the stars come out. It's a few minutes after the stars come out, but we're supposed to add to the Shabbos, the beginning and the end. And that's hinted because one time it says, Tishmoru means guard, keep, put a fence around it, like extend the Shabbos, in other words, right? But it says, my Shabbos you shall extend, or you should extend my Shabbos. So that teaches us before Shabbos and after Shabbos. But I want to draw your attention to an interesting thing here, which I'm going to give you a short answer and then give you a much more involved answer and go through a very, very interesting concept to do with Shabbos. When the Torah mentions here to keep Shabbos, as it does in many places in the Chumash, it says, et shabsoi sai tishmoiru. You shall keep my Shabboses in the plural. Right? Shabsoi sai means my more than one Shabbos, my Shabboses. I don't know how to translate it any other way. Right? What does that mean? Why two Shabboses? So one of the ways to understand this is to refer to a very famous apparent dispute between the Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi. Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. Babylonian Talmud is a famous concept which says that if the Yidden were to keep two Shabboses, they would be redeemed. Correct? Famous thing. Mashiach would come. The Yerushalmi says, if the Yidden will keep one Shabbos, they'll be redeemed. So it seems like a dispute. Is it one Shabbos we need, or is it two Shabbos? So in Kabbalah, there's a very famous explanation that actually the Bavli and Yerushalmi are not arguing, but that every Shabbos has two levels. And that's why the Torah says here, Shabsoi Sai, my Shabbos is. Because what is Shabbos? Shabbos is Emunah. Shabbos is about the world being elevated. Shabbos is about the world connecting to Hashem. And in this connection to Hashem, there are two levels. There's a general connection where a person becomes connected to Hashem or believes in Hashem. And then there's a deeper level of Emunah. There's two levels of Emunah. There's two levels of what we call Bittul. In other words, there's two levels where you can be committed to Hashem and believe in Hashem, but you still who you are. And then there's a higher level, a deeper commitment, a deeper consciousness where a person is completely given over to Emunah and to God in a complete way where he or she kind of almost loses their independent existence. And there's two levels of Shabbos, and Shabbos gives us the ability to start with one but to graduate eventually to a deeper level. So therefore the Bavli and Yerushalmi are actually not arguing. What's actually going on is that the Yerushalmi is saying if you keep one Shabbos, then the Geula will come. What the Bavli is saying is, Bavli is just explaining it, that you don't need to actually, it's one Shabbos, but you have to connect to both aspects of Shabbos, two levels of Shabbos. So it's two levels of the same Shabbos. Now that's just a general thing. But I want to take it to a whole new concept and explain to you the following. We have here the pasuk that says, Shabsoi sai tishmoiru. Guard my Shabboses, right? We also have a term which we say every Friday night when we sing V'shamru, where it says that you should keep the Shabbos. Hashem says V'shamru b'nei Yisrael es haShabbos, right? The Yidden will keep my Shabbos. What's the next word? La'asois es haShabbos, to make the Shabbos. We should make the Shabbos. So we have two expressions when it comes to Shabbos. One is a positive, active expression, making the Shabbos. The other one is much more of a passive expression, protect the Shabbos, guard the Shabbos, right? And when it comes to guarding the Shabbos, we find there's a double expression, it's plural, a Shabsoi Sai Tishmeru, guard my Shabboses. And when it comes to making the Shabbos, the active part of Shabbos, it's only singular. What I want to share with you is an explanation based on Kabbalistic writings that talks about actually three levels of Shabbos. And I'll explain to you what they are, and through that we'll also be able to explain a concept to do with the Yontif of Shavuos and the counting of the Omer, which we're in the middle of now. So, let me give you an introduction. This is a little bit complex, so fasten your seatbelts. The term Shomer in the Torah is not only about Shabbos. The term Shomer in the Torah, Shmira, to protect, is normally an expression used when it comes to negative commandments. In fact, with Shabbos also. We know that every Shabbos there's a negative and a positive, right? The negative is what you're not allowed to do on Shabbos, a lot of different halachas. Then we have the positive, La'asos the Shabbos, to do the Shabbos, or sometimes it's written in the word Zachoris Yom HaShabbos, to remember the Shabbos, which is all the positive commandments of Shabbos, making Kiddush, eating gefilte fish, whatever the case is, right? Davening, singing, learning, right? So generally in the Torah, we know the Torah is divided up into negative commandments, positive commandments. The word shmira, to protect, to guard, normally is a reference to negative commandments. Okay? Asiya, doing, remembering, action words are normally connected to positive commandments. Right? Now you can understand that because the word guarding is not an action. You don't do anything when you guard. You protect something from something else. That's why it's normally, you don't do, it's passive. Right? Whereas lasa is to do, zocha, remember, these are all positive action words that comes to the positive commandments. Now, in the Torah generally, we normally talk about positive commandments being higher than negative commandments. What do I mean? If we were to think, what is the purpose of creation? The negative commandments or the positive commandments? Positive commandments, right? Because positive commandments bring Hashem into the world. What's the function of the negative commandments? Just to stay away from things that interfere. So normally we look at negative commandments as a means to an end. In other words, just about keeping away the dirt, cleaning out the plate so that the plate is ready for the food. Making sure the palace where you want to invite the king into is not a dirty palace, but it's a clean palace and it's beautiful and it's been painted and it's clean so that the king can be invited in, right? So in other words, we look at the positive commandments of being the ikkar, being the higher experience, where we really get to connect to God, where we really get to bring God into the world. Whereas negative commandments are just a more means to an end and therefore a stepping stone towards positive commandments. And it's just about staying away from bad or cleaning out the mess so that we remain pure, so that we can... And the same thing with Shabbos. Often, and we spoke about this very, very often, particularly around the two Shabbos projects, where we talked about the concept of Zocha, the remembering of Shabbos being the main thing, because because that's what people misunderstand often. They think Shabbos is about not doing stuff. Not doing stuff is only a means to an end, which is true on one level. In other words, it's just about creating a platform. The main thing of Shabbos is really to experience the Shabbos. To experience positively, to experience the holiness of Shabbos by doing, by engaging, by experiencing, by learning, by davening, by singing, by reading, by eating, whatever the case is. The shamra, the not doing work, is just because we need to create that space. We need to disconnect from the week. So we disconnect from the week in order to create the space for the positive. While all of that is true, it is not entirely true. I never told you this yet, but it's not entirely true. Because sometimes we find, in Sifrei Kabbalah, we find that actually it's the opposite way around. That negative commandments are higher than positive commandments. Let me show you where this is hinted in the Torah. Go back to... give me one second. When Hashem first reveals himself to the burning bush, which is the beginning of our journey. Page 304. This is the famous part of the burning bush where Moshe Rabbeinu is reluctant to go to Mitzrayim. He asks Hashem for his name. Hashem doesn't give it to him. Hashem just says, I am who I am, or I'll be who I'll be. Go and tell them that I am. I sent you to them. And then suddenly in Pasuk Tesvav 15, right? Hashem says, Vayomer oid Elokim el Moshe. And Hashem further said to Moshe Rabbeinu, go and tell this to the Jewish people. Tell them the following. Hashem, Hashem, the God of your forefathers, the God of our forefathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, has sent me to you. And tell them, Zeshmi le'olam, this is my name forever. Zichri le'dor dor, this is my remembrance from generation to generation. What does that phrase mean? So in Kabbalah it explains that this phrase is actually a reference to the mitzvahs that were to come. And Hashem says, you want to know about my name? You want to connect to my name? You're going to have to connect to my name through the mitzvahs. And the name of Hashem, the ultimate name of Hashem, Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey, is in two parts. Yud and Hey, the second part is Vav and Hey. And the two expressions, Zeh Shmi L'Oil, this is my name forever, and this is my remembrance, Shmi and Zichri, is a reference to the negative commandments and the positive commandments. Shmi is connected to Yud and Hey. Zichri is connected to Vav and Hey. How so? So look carefully. The word Shmi, the gematria of the word Shmi, is 350, correct? Shmi, Shin, Mem, Yud, yeah, 340, 10. Add that on to Yud and Hey of Hashem's name, 15, you get 365. That's the 365 negative commandments. Right? Zichri is 237. Added on to the 11 of Vav and Hey, you get 248, which is the negative command, which is the positive commandments. So they explain the following: that through the observance of a negative commandment, you reach the higher part of Hashem's name. Yud Hey, Yud Hey is the higher part of Hashem's name. Why? Because Yudke Vavke is divided into two parts. The Yud and the Hey represents Hashem, how He is for Himself. The Vav, and it always explains in Kabbalah, that means it's a Vav is a letter that comes, the Yud with the Yud extends, that comes all the way down. It's how Hashem chooses to engage with the world. It's how He's lowering Himself to engage with the world. Still Him, but He's lowering Himself to engage with the world. So therefore, Yud and Hey is the higher level of Hashem's name. Vav and Hey is the lower level. They're both part of Hashem's name. When you do a mitzvah, as Loisa say, when you keep away from something you're not supposed to do, you connect to a higher part of Hashem's name. When you do a mitzvah, as say, it's only the lower part of Hashem's name. Both important, but mitzvah, as Loisa say, on one level are higher than the mitzvah, as say. The negative commandments are on one level higher than the positive commandments. Why? Doesn't this go counter to what we always explain? That doing is the main thing, bringing Hashem, revealing Hashem in the world is the main thing. That's true. But what's the implication of something you don't do? When you don't do something, it's passive. You know what passivity refers to? Sorry? Restraint. But it's more than that. When you do a mitzvah, you're doing something. You're accomplishing something. When you don't do something, in other words, when the mitzvah is to remain passive, it's because you want to connect to something that actually is transcendent. It's too high for you to engage in. And the only way you can get it is by means of a gift. And therefore the gift is, Hashem says, okay, there are certain things I will give you, there are certain levels I will connect you to which you can't accomplish. You can't actually do something to make it happen. What you can do is, you can surrender. Like we spoke about before, bitachon. You can be passive. You can not do something. And the act of restraint, the act of not doing something, the act of passivity, is the act of surrender and allows you then just to be open for Hashem to pour in something which you cannot get on your own. Okay? So that's a new insight into the concept of a negative commandment. The concept of a negative commandment is that we want to reach something which we can't make happen. We can only make happen by not doing anything, by being passive. To say, I shut down, I'm open to something new. Doing something means I'm doing something, which means I'm doing something that I, with my efforts, can connect to. It might be very high and beautiful and lofty, but it's still accessible enough for me to be able to accomplish it. The mitzvah's loisase is yudke, because the mitzvah's loisase connect us to Hashem before He lowers Himself to engage with the world. The transcendent level of Hashem. It allows us just to be passive and connect to Hashem in a complete way. Now, yeah, we're okay so far? Let's take us to Shabbos. Shabbos is a gift from Hashem. Now we know this, that Shabbos is something which Hashem gave us as a gift. Something which we don't create. It's not like Yontif, which we have to make the calendar to create, and all this, as we said just another shiur recently. So therefore, there's a gift. However, Hashem says He wants us to accomplish something in the Shabbos as well. So therefore, with Shabbos, we have two aspects of Shabbos. We have the negative and the positive. The negative and the positive is, Shomer is the negative, which represents the gift aspect of Shabbos. That's why it's passive. It's what you don't do. which gives us a whole new insight into the don'ts of Shabbos. It's not just to create a space. When we don't do, it's an act of surrender. When we don't do, we're leaving ourselves open to an amazing gift. But Hashem says there are certain things I want you to do. There's certain things I want you, because at the end of the day, there's an advantage in a positive commandment, because there's something very precious about something that we accomplish on our own. So therefore, Hashem says there's certain things which you can accomplish, which you need to accomplish, and therefore that's the positive of the Shabbos. There are experiences you can connect to, and therefore you have to connect to, and that's the la'asoyses ha-Shabbos, that's the do the Shabbos. However, when it comes to the passive part of Shabbos, suddenly we see that there's a plural. There's two passive parts of Shabbos. What's that all about? So here's how it works. Shabbos comes in three stages. As many things do, but we're very emphasized with Shabbos. The first part of Shabbos is when a person is not ready for any part of Shabbos. There's sometimes we're not ready, we need a gift at any level because we're not ready to accomplish anything. We're so immersed in the weekday that we're not even able to accomplish things which we should be able to accomplish. We're just weekday-ish. And therefore, step one of Shabbos is Hashem says, let me kickstart you. Let me give you a gift, just a small gift, a part of Shabbos. Let me give it to you to get you going. That's how Shabbos begins. So Shabbos begins with a shomer, with a low level of shomer. Just abstain, so you get kickstarted. So I'll pour in a bit of gift of Shabbos, a taste of Shabbos, a preview of Shabbos, so you get going. However, Hashem says, once you've done that, now take over. The next part is you fully engage with Shabbos to the maximum of your ability, as much as you can possibly accomplish, to get whatever you can get out of Shabbos now that I've given you the kickstart. That's part two of Shabbos. That's last says Shabbos. However, says Hashem, if you do that, then I'm going to give you the opportunity, once you've done everything that you can possibly do, because you've taken advantage of my initial inspiration, now I'm going to take you back to the Shomer. I'm going to take you back to being passive. Because what I will do now is, once you've done everything you can possibly do, I will take you and give you a gift of a level which is impossible for any human to reach, which you will not be able to accomplish through the efforts that you are accomplishing, but I will give it to you as a gift, because you're going to go back into passive mode, and therefore I will give you that gift, which I'll only give you because you've done whatever you can, but it's a gift because you're not reaching it through your efforts. It has to become as a gift because it's way beyond, it's way transcendent, and it's way infinitely higher than what you can accomplish yourself. So the Mefarshim explain that actually in Shabbos itself, although the whole of Shabbos is both, the Mefarshim explain that actually these three parts of Shabbos correspond to the three meals of Shabbos. Friday night is Shomer. In fact, in Lachadoidi, we mentioned this before, in Lachadoidi, even though we got to do it, but in Lachadoidi, when we talk about the two expressions of Shomer and Zachar, we say Shomer first. Because when Shabbos comes in, we the first thing we have to do is be passive. Just let Hashem do the work. Which is why Friday night is actually, in a way, it's a very passive experience. What I mean? Yes, we've got a shul and we sing and all that, but it's actually more about inspiration. We light candles and let the light come in. We, of course, we do things, but the emphasis of Friday night is Shomer. It's the energy. There's a special energy on Friday night that is kind of just there. If you in Eretz Yisrael, it's even more. If you ever went to the Kosel on Friday night, it's a gift. It's a gift energy. Because Friday night kickstarts the Shabbos. And that's why Friday night corresponds to the first level of Shabbos. What's the first level of Shabbos? Shomer. The lower level Shomer. The gift, but the lower level gift just to energize us when we're not able to do anything ourselves. Then Hashem says, now you get working. Shabbos morning corresponds to last Sosas HaShabbos. You got to go to shul for a longer time. You got to read the Torah. You got to study the parasha. You got to say Divrei Torah. You got to put in the work. It's the whole day of Shabbos. The whole day of Shabbos is for you to do. What's the holiest time of Shabbos? In Kabbalah we learn. The holiest time of Shabbos is after Mincha. Because after Mincha is the ultimate gift of Shabbos. It's called in Zohar, it's called Raiva Derivin. It's the innermost desire and pleasure that Hashem gives us comes on Shabbos afternoon. In fact, Shabbos afternoon is a time of Shalosh Shudas. And besides practical reasons, we know that the tradition is that when we eat Shalosh Shudas, it's always a toned down meal. In Old Shtetlach, Shalosh Shudas used to consist of a bit of sardines and bread. Huh? Lekach or roll, whatever the case is, right? It's a ton. Why? There's all of a sudden a tremendous why? Because the ultimate gift of Shabbos actually doesn't come every Shabbos. The ultimate gift of Shabbos will come when Mashiach comes. Because when Mashiach comes, we know that'll be a Shabbos experience. We say that's like the seventh day of creation. That'll be the ultimate existence of Shabbos, where Hashem will give us the highest revelation, things that we can never reach on our own, but we reach it through doing whatever we can do now. Right? When is there a taste of Mashiach on Shabbos? Shabbos afternoon. Shabbos afternoon, it says that's like Ma'ein Olam Haba. It's like that's like Mashiach's experience. The taste of Mashiach is the whole of Shabbos, but particularly Shabbos afternoon. That's why it's a very spiritual time. Anyone who like Shalosh Shudas is the time to sing songs to some rebbes or rabbonim, whatever, they teach secrets of Torah. I remember Rabbi Amar was here, and he spoke here. On Shalosh Shudas, he says he hopes no one minds, but he has a minhag on Shalosh Shudas, he only teaches Kabbalah. Why? That's esoterics. It's the hidden, the secrets. Shabbos afternoon is a secret time, less emphasis on food, more emphasis on song, on introspection. It's the going out of Shabbos. It's the ultimate house Shabbos. It's the second Shomer. So the Friday night meal is the first Shomer. The Shabbos morning meal is the last place to do the Shabbos. Shabbos afternoon is the second Shomer. Hashem gives us a gift. Passivity kickstarts us. We get involved, we do whatever we can, action, last as Shabbos, and then we become passive again, where Hashem gives us the ultimate gift. And the truth is, that same formula is Pesach, the Omer, and Shavuos. When we start counting the Omer, the second day Pesach. What is the Omer? Omer is 49 days of hard work. Omer is personal growth. Omer is working on ourselves, refining ourselves. Climbing a ladder of personal development and refining of our midos, etc., etc. Why do we start the second day Pesach? Because the first day Pesach, Hashem had to give us a gift first. He has to schlep us out of Mitzrayim. There was no way we can go out of Mitzrayim without Hashem taking us. We were so sunken into Mitzrayim, there was no way it could happen. So Hashem takes out of Mitzrayim. Yitzias Mitzrayim, the original liberation from Egypt, was a total revelation from above. It was a total gift. We didn't do anything to deserve it. Nothing. We weren't worthy. It says that we say it in our Agada. We weren't worthy of going out of Mitzrayim. But Hashem gave us a gift. He kickstarted. But Hashem said, we're not giving the Torah just yet. I've taken you out. Now you work. Work to refine your animal. Work to refine your personality, to refine the animalistic parts of who you are. 7 weeks corresponding to the 7 emotions of the animal soul. All the stuff we've talked about many, many times. But then an amazing thing happened. Because it's in the number 7, and we know we have 7 parts of our animal soul, 7 emotions that we have to work on, 7 parts of our personality. But if you look in last week's parasha, where it talks about the mitzvah of counting the Omer, there's almost a contradiction. It says you should count for 7 weeks, and then it says, Tisperu chamishim yoyim, you shall count 50 days. We don't count 50 days. 50 days is Shavuos, but we don't count 50 days. Why does it say count 50 days? The answer is very simple. We count 49 days because 49 days we can count. It's action mitzvahs. It's what we can accomplish, what we can do. We can climb the ladder of personal growth as much as we can reach our perfection. We can perfect ourselves as much as a human being can possibly reach. The number 50, we know, is the number of transcendence. The number 50 is that level that a person cannot reach. But Hashem gives it to us. That's why in the Pasuk it says you should count 50 days. Because we'll get the 50th level. But the 50th level is the second level gift. It's like the second Shomer. That's why Hashem says, the 50th day, don't count. Just, I'll give it to you. I'll only give it to you if you count the 49. In other words, I'll kickstart you at the beginning. You will then do whatever you can do. And then you'll go back to being passive and I'll give you the greatest gift. The gift of the number 50, which is the gift of Shavuos. But I'll give it to you because you've done what you can. Therefore, you deserve for me to give you what you cannot do on your own, which is the 50th level. So the Pesach, Omer, and Shavuos is actually the same formula as the 3 parts of Shabbos. The first Shomer, Lasso is to do the Shabbos, and the second Shomer. Have a good day.